Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
It's great having a subject who is, like, for instance, Alfred Hitchcock. You know, he starts making films, and then if you wrote a book about Alfred Hitchcock, it would then be, you know, and then he made Psycho, and then he made Birds, and then he made, and it would just be one film after another. So someone like Wilder and Malick, they have lives that are really dense and interesting, as well as making films.
Right, right. Well, I think that's really important in today's world, especially. I tell this to students all the time because I teach at San Francisco State University. I teach cinema, and they complain about taking GE classes, general education, things like history, sociology, literature. And I tell them those are the most important classes you're going to take as a filmmaker, because what else are you going to make movies about? And I once was at USC with Orson Welles. We were shooting a scene for Other Side of the Wind that didn't get into the film, but he was doing a scene where he was playing the old director and he was being interviewed by students. And some guy said to him, what do you think should be taught at film schools? And Welles said, I wouldn't show any films. And this guy seemed really shocked. And Welles said, you've all seen too many films, you know, just go out and make films. And the guy said, well, what would you teach? And Welles spread his arms really wide. And he said, I would teach the history of the world.
Yeah.
So we're missing that with a lot of the young filmmakers. All they know is old movies and TV shows or current movies and TV shows. And, you know, they're kind of imitating other filmmakers. But the filmmakers, the great filmmakers of the earlier period, had lives before they got into films. You know, they were, you know, race car drivers, aviators. Leo McCarey was a lawyer. People were in the military, and, you know, you name it. Buster Keaton was an acrobat and vaudevillian, and Frank Capra had all kinds of different jobs, and Billy Wilder was a journalist. And I'm being a journalist myself, I thought, well, let's spend a lot of time digging into his journalism. And so he worked in Vienna and Berlin, and there are two books out in German of his journalism, one the Viennese journalism and the other the Berlin. And then there was a book in English that kind of picked the highlights of both, but there are a lot of things in the German books that weren't published in the English book. But anyway, it was really interesting to see his development as a writer, and also the things he later made movies about. You know, there are echoes of Sunset Boulevard and Some Like It Hot. I mean, for example, Some Like It Hot, there was a group of English girl dancers called the Tiller Girls, who he had tremendous kind of sexual fascination with, and they were kind of syncopated dancers, and they came to Berlin on the train, just like the girls' band does in Some Like It Hot. And they had a strict band leader, just like the Sweet Sue and Some Like It Hot. And Billy Wilder wrote these kind of very excited, lubricious kind of articles about the Tiller Girls, and he fell in love with one of them, and he wrote a poem about her that was published. And you could see the connections. And he wasn't a great journalist, but the thing he wrote that was the best and would make a good movie is rather well known. It's called Waiter, Bring Me a Dancer. And he was what they called an Eintänzer, which means tea dancer. And in those days, at the big hotels in Berlin, they had dances in the evening where ladies, young or old, would come and dance with handsome young guys for tips. And so Wilder wrote a four-part series, which is just fascinating. It's kind of like, it would make a great movie, just like Cabaret, kind of, you know. And it's all about the kind of hypocrisies involved in being suave and charming, and the humiliations, and the kind of feminization of the dancer too. And speaking of which, Wilder wrote a girl's advice column, female advice column, under a girl's name in Berlin too. That's another echo, or echo is not the right word, but precursor of Some Like It Hot.
Absolutely. I'm reading those early chapters of the book, sometimes there's a risk with a biography of someone who, as we've just said, has a life prior to the. I remember a biography of Raymond Chandler, which quoted his phrase, you know, who cares when the writer got his first bicycle? And there is a sort of maybe a temptation at times to think, oh, I'll just skip to when they start being the person I want them to be. But with these chapters, what's really interesting is how you put in, oh, this is where this could have come from, this could have been an inspiration for this. So the films are already there right from the beginning.
Yeah, Leon Edel, the great biographer of Henry James, wrote a wonderful book called Writing Lives, which I read every time I write a biography. And one point he made was biographers should be free in chronology. It shouldn't, and that kind of picks up on what you were saying, and I want to comment on that, that it doesn't have to be in this and this and this and this in strict chronological order, because he said, lives have connections, and so something that happened to Billy Wilder when he was 14 or whatever might appear in a film much later, or have some influence on him later. And certainly there are many things in his life. For example, when he found out his father had an adulterous relationship, and he had another child that his mother didn't know about, and Billy kept it a secret, and then he had this kind of, he held this over his father in a sense. And I mean, that's, these kind of things really had a lot of connection with Wilder's later life. And he said, for example, his father ran a string of hotels, and he said, I learned most of what I knew about life hanging around one of the hotels. And he said, probably, you know, a lot of the worst things about life you learn in a hotel, you know, playing pool and drinking and hanging out with all kinds of itinerant people. And, you know, but that's why he was such a sophisticated guy at a very early age, and a wise guy, you know, in both senses of the word. And that served him well in life, because he had to grow up quickly, and he became a journalist at a very early age. And then he went to Berlin and had to scramble for a living, and he became a screenwriter. But then Nazism came, and he had to flee the country, and he was in exile several times over. And I also deal with the Holocaust and its effect on his family, and that was a profound part of his life that he didn't talk about very much, but that it devastated him. Excuse me. His mother and his stepfather and his grandmother were killed in the Holocaust, and he never knew, apparently, that his mother died at Plaszow, the camp in, if people have seen Schindler's List, that's the camp run by Amon Goeth, the Ralph Fiennes character, psychopathic Nazi. His mother was in Krakow, and she was taken to that camp and died. He thought she died in Auschwitz. He never knew for sure. But he tried. He went to Vienna in 1935, and this had a big effect on his whole life. He knew, being a journalist and sophisticated political guy, that Austria was not a safe place for his parents, for his mother and stepfather to live. And he scraped together some money in Hollywood, and he went to Vienna and tried to talk them into coming to America, and they wouldn't leave because they were, number one, they were too, they're old, and two, like a lot of Jews in Europe, they didn't believe that it would get as bad as it did. But Billy kind of foresaw that, and he said that Vienna was much more anti-Semitic than Berlin, which is interesting and kind of counterintuitive. And so he really knew these things, and but he felt terribly guilty that he couldn't rescue his mother and stepfather and grandmother. And that kind of plays out in his films. He wanted to end his career with Schindler's List, actually. And Spielberg, who I wrote a biography of, was hesitating for about 10 years to make that film, because he realized what a difficult challenge it was, and what a profound experience it would be for him. And he finally did it. But in the period in between, Wilder had some talks with Spielberg, and he thought Spielberg was never going to make it. So he called him and said, you know, I'd like to direct this film and you could produce it, or vice versa. Wilder was getting pretty old at the time, and he probably would have been too old to make a film that demanding at the time. But Spielberg had to tell him the film was in pre-production, going into shooting in a very few months. And he said it was the most difficult phone call he ever had to make, but he said Wilder was a real gentleman about it, and when he saw the film, he thought it was the greatest film he'd ever seen, and he wrote a review of it for a Bavarian newspaper, which is interesting, because Bavaria was where the Nazis started, you know, where Hitler came from, and he wanted to counter Holocaust denial, for one thing, and he talked about how vivid the film was, and he said, he concluded by writing, for people who deny the Holocaust, I just have one question: where is my mother? You know, very powerful ending. And when I did the Spielberg book, I wanted to interview Holocaust survivors about the film and ask them what they thought. And I interviewed 35 of them, and they all told me basically the same couple things. One was that the film was so vivid that it was just like being back there, which was, you know, a great compliment to Spielberg's artistry. But they also said Ralph Fiennes was too handsome to play the part, because the real Amon Goeth was a loathsome looking fellow, and Spielberg, I think, wanted him to be more, you know, normal looking, so people wouldn't just see him as a caricature. But the other thing they said was it wasn't as violent as the real events. And Spielberg admitted that, you know, there were things that were so horrifying that if you showed them, people would run out of the theater. And I heard some stories from these people that, you know, there's one story I won't even tell people because it would ruin their entire year to hear the story, you know. But anyway, back to Billy Wilder. He was, Well, the point you made about chronology, it's very interesting. When I was writing this book, which took about 10 years off and on, well, I took a long break in between. I was writing a book on Lubitsch. I first had what I thought was a bright idea, write a book on Lubitsch and Wilder together, because Wilder was a protege of Lubitsch. And he had the famous sign on his wall, "How would Lubitsch do it?" So I called my book, "How Did Lubitsch Do It?" But after about a year writing about the two of them, I realized, number one, they were as different as they're similar, and number two, the book would be inordinately long because they both had huge careers. So I spun off the Wilder part and I went back to it later. But in the early parts of the book, I kept to the regular chronology, but I did occasionally look forward, as I said, to other things that he would do. But when I got to the films he directed, I thought about it, and I must say I'm kind of tired of the whole approach of writing about films chronologically. I mean, I've done that myself, and most other film book writers do that. They, you know, it's a critical study, not a biography. If it were a biography, right, you kind of need to be more chronological. But when I got to the films he directed in Hollywood, 1942 onward, he had directed a film in France in 1934, and I had written about that. But I began thinking, I put a lot of thought into it, and I thought, well, I don't want to do this chronologically. I want to do it thematically. And so I wrote about, you know, the different ideas and themes and motifs and stories and connections. And it took a lot of thinking and outlining, but it sort of fell into place because there was a certain logic to it. And I think it reads well, and I really enjoyed doing it that way. And it's a kind of unorthodox experimental way to write a critical study, but I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And I mean, when he's when he goes from Berlin and he decides I'm not going to survive if I stay here, I have to get out. I mean, there's this horrible scene where he Billy Wilder's witnesses an old man being beaten to death on the streets, and nobody doing anything. He includes himself in that nobody doing anything. He includes his own inability to intervene without, you know, potentially putting himself in a great deal of danger. He is one of quite a few. A whole number of refugees people who are fleeing and there's this brilliant scene that you write about how he arrives in America and the sort of border, some sort of official bureaucrat. It's a great scene of tension where he's sort of pacing up and down behind Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder doesn't know what's going to happen, and he finally stamps his passport, and he asks him, "What do you do?" And he says, "I write films." He says, "Oh, well, write some good ones," as he gives him the passport and allows him into the country.
Yeah, isn't that a wonderful story? Wow, I mean, it's so moving. And I, by the way, if people are interested, there's a film magazine called Bright Lights. It's an online film magazine that I love. Gary, the guy who runs it, is a terrific fellow who does it on his own, and I've been writing for them since the 70s. But anyway, I put my article on my section from the book on Hold Back the Dawn, which is a film that not too many people know about, but it's Billy's most autobiographical film, but he didn't direct it, which is interesting. It's directed by Mitchell Lyson, who's a good director who's kind of neglected. But it's about a refugee in Mexico at the border, played by Charles Boyer, who is desperate to get into the U.S. And it was kind of based on Wilder's own experiences, as you mentioned, being in Mexico. He got a visa to come to America for 6 months to work for Columbia Pictures, and then he had to leave the country again. And so a lot of people were stuck in hotels in Mexico, and they could be stuck for years in that period because we had strict quotas on immigration. And Wilder had to go into this consul. He never remembered the guy's name. He thought it was the consul. He found out later it was an assistant consul. And I found out the man's name was Willis Myers. And I think one reason why Mr. Myers was so benevolent toward him was he was an amateur magician. And I think, he was kind of a member of the family of show business, and he was, he was kind of part of the gang with Billy Wilder, and he made his whole life and career possible. I mean, we probably, I don't know what would have happened to Billy Wilder if this man hadn't been kind to him. And so in Bright Lights, if people want to read that section, I put that in there, and I found documents that I didn't have in my book. One is Billy Wilder's application for citizenship and for a visa. I have both of those in there, very interesting documents to look at. And then I found a picture of Willis Myers, very obscure fellow, but I found a little picture of him. But he gave tribute when he won the Thalberg Award in the 80s. Most of his speech was about this one sweet man in Tijuana, or not Tijuana, it was Mexicali, Mexico, who made his whole career possible. Very, very poignant speech.
Yeah, I've tried to make good films ever since,
Yeah, to thank this dear man in Mexicali. And oh, I mentioned the editor of the magazine, Gary Morris. I should give him credit. Gary is a terrific guy who I love the idea that one guy has a film magazine that he keeps going. It used to be a print magazine, and now it's an online publication. And it's really delightful because he's very eclectic, and he's very good with writers. He kind of lets writers do their thing, and he's a very benevolent editor too, so I'd like to publish with him whenever I can.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a brilliant recommendation as well for anybody who's looking for some more quality online writing on film. So when we get Wilder in America, he's of course he's there are lots of people around him who he's to some degree worked with already in Berlin in his sort of nascent career. But he's also he kind of you point out that he's at a very low point in his career at this point. There's no, he doesn't feel like he's in the right country even necessarily. He doesn't feel like he's clicking. What do you feel is the turning point for him where it sort of starts to go right?
Well, the low point, he said, was when he came back from Vienna, feeling terribly depressed about not being able to talk his mother into coming over. He had been living in he liked to say it was the ladies' bathroom at the Chateau Marmont Hotel. It was probably the little anteroom before you get into the ladies' bathroom, and often in ladies' bathrooms they have a little cot where ladies can lie down. And so he had had a room in the hotel, and they gave it up. They said they were going to save it for him when he got back, but they didn't. So he had to live in the anteroom of the ladies' bathroom. He said that was the lowest point of his life, but he soon rebounded. He was working very hard on scripts, and but the turning point was 1936. The year after that, he was freelancing, selling a few scripts, and there was a guy named Manny Wolf at Paramount, who was another benevolent fellow who deserves credit. He was the story editor at Paramount, and he recognized Billy Wilder as an up-and-coming, talented, bright fellow, and he teamed him with Charles Brackett. Charles Brackett, who I write about a lot in the book, was one of Wilder's two big collaborators. Wilder almost always had a collaborator, even in Germany. I think there were only three films that he ever worked on totally on his own. But in America, he felt he needed a collaborator who was very good with English, for one thing. And Brackett was a very literate man. He had been the drama editor of The New Yorker, and he was a member of the Algonquin Roundtable. He wrote novels, et cetera, urbane, sophisticated guy. But he was very different from Wilder. He was a conservative Republican blue blood from New York, and he was actually a bank president, family bank. And, but he was hooked up with Wilder, and Wolf had the sense to realize that Brackett, who was very suave and sophisticated and all that, needed a bit of a kind of a charge with some kind of livelier collaborator. Brackett's stuff on his own was a little, I don't know what the word is, a palette, but he was very elegant, but he needed a guy with a hard charging sense of narrative and and colorful characters, et cetera. And Wilder had that. But Wilder's English was not too great. He learned English, he said, by listening to the radio, listening to sports on the radio and pop music and things, and also dating as many American girls as he could and listening to them.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah, that's why he was dating the girls, absolutely. It was,
yeah,
it was,
yeah, that's purely what education. He claimed. Well, it kills two birds with one stone, right? Yeah, yeah, he, yeah, I found an interview with somebody at the hotel who said, every time I saw him, he was with a different girl, you know? yeah, that's funny. But anyway, so he and Brackett were teamed, and Ernst Lubitsch needed writers, and Manny Wolf. Lubitsch was at a turning point in his career too, because the production code had come in 1934 and was very strict, and Lubitsch was really clever at getting around the censorship that existed before that, but the censorship became extremely severe. And so he took time off and he became head of production at Paramount, which didn't work out too well because he was not the kind of guy who could supervise other people very well. He was too autocratic. But he made an amazing film called Angel, which is his most subtle film, because it's about a, Marlene Dietrich plays an aristocratic British, or she's married to an aristocratic British fellow, and she goes to Paris on weekends to moonlight in a brothel, which is kind of astounding for film made under the code. And it's kind of like Belle de Jour, you know, the Buñuel film. And Lubitsch made this film and he got away with it because he was so sophisticated, but it didn't do particularly well. So he was trying to do a screwball comedy, which was not really his forte, but that's the kind of film that was being made. And as Andrew Saris said, the screwball comedy was known to Hollywood screenwriters as the unfinished fuck film. Another, that's why people in screwball comedies are hitting each other all the time. Men and women are slugging each other and throwing themselves around. It's not my favorite genre, and it's not Lubitsch's forte, because he was into urbane comedy where men and women were kind of learning how to deal with each other. But he made Bluebeard's Eighth Wife with Brackett and Wilder, and it's not not a good film. It's not a good Lubitsch film. Brackett that saw it about a year later and thought it was really terrible. But it led to Ninotchka, which was a great film, 1939. Everything worked in that film. Lubitsch went to MGM and he worked with Brackett and Wilder and Charles, Walter Reisch, who was another German writer who Wilder had worked with in Germany. And they wrote a really great screenplay, and Wilder became a very important writer because of that. And he and Brackett were getting some of the best assignments. And very soon after that, Wilder convinced Paramount to let him have a shot at directing. Preston Sturges had sort of pioneered this. Being a writer director was not a common thing back then, but Sturges and then John Huston and then Orson Welles kind of made that possible. And so Billy Wilder got a shot, and he made The Major and the Minor, which he said he thought, well, I'm going to make a very commercial film, because if they expect me to make some kind of art film and flop, and then I'll go back to being a writer. But he made something very commercial. But it's actually a very subversive film, because it's a film about pedophilia, of all things. It's Ray Milland plays a nearsighted army guy. Actually, he's an instructor at a military school in Wisconsin. And he's on a train. Ginger Rogers is masquerading as a 12-year-old girl to escape mashers in New York. And she hides out in his train compartment, and he develops a kind of an affection for her without realizing she's 12. I mean, the gag in the film is everybody who sees this film realizes, you know, that she's not a 12-year-old kid, but the people in the film don't realize it. And Wilder plays all kinds of riffs on people's inability to see what's right in front of their own eyes. It's a very daring film. It's, as you said, it's Lolita way out of its time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, also, I mean, I just want to say, we would say in Italian, precisare,
make a point about Bluebeard's wife. You said it's not a good Lubitsch film, which I think I should warn anyone who hasn't seen it, which means it's a good film. It's just not a good Lubitsch film. Yeah. You know, well, it's still, I would argue it's still a very good film. It's just, compared to his very high standard, it's not one of his best.
I see your point. I mean, the weak Lubitsch is, much better than everybody else's good film. I just find, if you see the trailer for that, if people want to look online and see the trailer, it's really outrageous because Paramount sold it as Gary Cooper and Claudia Colbert whacking each other around, and it's a very unpleasant trailer. And Paramount says in the trailer, here's the Lubitsch touch, and Gary Cooper is bopping Claudia Colbert and she's hitting him, and that's not really the Lubitsch touch. I mean, he's urbane and sophisticated, but Paramount was getting tired of Lubitsch at this point. They thought he was over the hill. Mm. And so they were kind of trashing the Lubitsch touch in their trailer. But if you like that kind of raucous romantic comedy, it's got its moments. It ends in a very kind of dark, funny way. I mean, parts of it are very dark in a sense.
I remember enjoying it. And the major and the minor, of course, you're talking about the pedophilia and the Lolita aspect. It's right there in the title as well, isn't it? The a legal definition of a child.
Yeah, I mean, it is so amazing that the people in when he takes her to the military school and introduces her, nobody can see through the disguise except for there's a teenage girl, Diana Lynn, who's just wonderful in the film, and she became kind of a up and coming star and never quite made it, but she's just great in the film. So it takes another teenager to recognize that Ginger Rogers is not a teenage or a sub-teen girl, and they become kind of allies. Wilder's a very good director of women, by the way. And, you know, in my book, I was trying to dispel some myths, which I like to do that when I write film books, because there's a lot of mythology and a lot of confusion surrounding great filmmakers. And Billy Wilder, the common misconception, and if people don't like Billy Wilder, they don't like him for two reasons, one of two reasons. One is they think he's too cynical. That word keeps appearing. And, I don't see anything wrong with, I once used the word thoughtlessly to Wilder.
Yeah, when you interviewed him yourself.
Yeah, I interviewed him numerous times, and he said, but if I'm cynical, what adjective do you have for Peckinpah pictures? Which I thought was a great quote. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, cynical is just another word for realistic, isn't it? And he said, yeah, every play by Ibsen was cynical, right? Every play by Strindberg was cynical. He said once in another interview that if you don't walk around Hollywood with a big grin on your face all the time, they think you're cynical, like if you're not a moron.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a realistic fellow, and he'd lived through hell, and he knew what the world was like. And to me, people who complain about that are Pollyannas, frankly. I mean, yeah. I don't understand that at all. So I try to dispel that. And I think what he really was, and his partner I.A.L. Diamond, who became his second screenwriting partner later on, he said Wilder was a disappointed romantic, which I think hits the nail on the head. And he compared him to Arthur Schnitzler, and Schnitzler, the writer of Le Rond, for example, great film, or a great play that became a great Max Ophuls film. And it's realistic film about sex and trading partners and all kinds of things. I think it was Andrew Saris who said the only thing the characters have in common in that play is syphilis.
he was also Schnitzler, the author of Dream Story as well, Traum.
Yeah.
He wrote, Eyes Wide Shut was based on.
Right, Traum novella. He wrote that wonderful novella. He was very much like Freud, and Freud felt such an affinity with Schnitzler that he thought, I could have written those books myself. Actually, there's a great Billy Wilder story about Schnitzler that supposedly when Wilder was a journalist in Vienna, in one day, the story goes, he interviewed Schnitzler, Richard Strauss, Richard Adler, and Sigmund Freud. in one day. And the story ends with he goes into Freud's house, his apartment, and Freud comes out with a little napkin around his neck as he's having lunch, and Wilder gives him his card saying he's a journalist, and Freud points to the door and says, "Raus," meaning get out, because he didn't like journalists. And I said to Wilder, "You really interviewed these four guys in one day?" And he kind of looked sheepish. He said, "Well, it was really 2 days, you know." But nobody's been able to find that article. And I said to Wilder, "What was this? What were you interviewing these guys about?" And he said, "Well, the publication he was writing for their Christmas number, I think it was 1925, wanted to interview famous people about Mussolini, who was the hot new thing in Italy, and fascism had just come up. And so Wilder was going around supposedly asking these people about fascism," which is an interesting thing. But nobody's been able to find that article. The guys who edited these anthologies of Wilder's work never found it. So it may be an apocryphal story, but it's one of the great stories. But the other thing about Wilder, I think he's a disappointed romantic. And I think he's actually a very romantic filmmaker in a lot of ways. A lot of his films are love stories, and a surprising number of them are kind of semi-musicals. And he has a lot of joie de vivre and a lot of romance in his films, but a lot of darkness as well and complications, just like happens to many romances. And but he also in his later work, when the production code was thrown away in the late 60s. And you could do almost anything in films, Wilder didn't just sort of let it all hang out. He went the opposite direction and made very romantic films in a period when romance was considered a dirty word. I remember that well. In America, if people wanted to insult you, they'd say, "You're romantic," you know, which sort of meant you're a sap, I guess. And but he made The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which is a great film, even though it's been cut severely, still holds up. Avanti, which I think is a wonderful film, which kind of went nowhere in the United States, but it was received well in Europe. And Fedora is a very problematic film, has a lot of production trouble, but it's a very romantic film in a lot of ways. And so he became, he was kind of like a latent romantic, and he let it all out. The other thing that people think is that he was a misogynist, and I don't think he was at all. And actually, Molly Haskell, who's a great writer about women in cinema, among other things, just read what she said about my book. She said, "With his Walk on the Dark Side comedies and refusal to sentimentalize, Wilder's reputation has only grown with time, and this magisterial critical study does full justice to his complex talent. McBride draws stunning connections between the life and the art, and his discussion of Wilder's treatment of women is especially fresh and persuasive. Both massive and entertaining, this is a must-read for Wilder fans." So her point is that he doesn't sentimentalize women, which is what makes people think he's a misogynist, because in the old Hollywood, they tended to sentimentalize women in general, but women were categorized as Madonnas or whores. And so there were women who were condemned for having healthy sexual appetites or having some kind of negative personality trait or whatever. But Wilder is not the kind of filmmaker who condemns people. He's very tolerant, like Lubitsch. But he has strict standards of his own. But he doesn't sentimentalize women in a kind of goofy way like a lot of the old filmmakers used to have to do. He sees women as flawed and mixtures of good and bad, just like guys. And there are only actually about three women in his entire body of work who are just out and out villainouses. And I would say Barbara Stanwyck, obviously, in Double Indemnity, is a psychopath, and Paula Prentice in Buddy Buddy. And let's see, there's a third one. Jan Sterling's character in Ace in the Hole, which is a great film, but she's very venal, but you understand why she's venal, you know. But the other women in his work, a lot of them, there are many, many what you'd call good women in his films, such as Shirley MacLaine in The Apartment is just a great character. I gave Wilder the Career Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association in 1995. And when we were having lunch before he got the award, I said, what do you think is your best film? And he said, The Apartment. And I said, why do you think so? And he said, well, it's the best mixture of comedy and drama that I ever did. And he said, I was always trying to achieve that. And I thought I did that in that film. And so Shirley MacLaine plays a woman who is not the kind of person Hollywood would have dealt with in the past, because she's cheating. Well, she's having an affair with her boss, or actually Jack Lemmon's boss, Fred McMurray, who's a married man. But she's being victimized by this guy who's a heartless cad. And, you know, she's just one of a string of women he's promising to marry when his wife will divorce him, which is the oldest line in the book. But she's a lovable character, and Jack Lemmon loves her. And, you know, I mean, it's very complex tone. But Wilder just loves Shirley MacLaine's character. But she's a flawed human being, just like all of us. And, you know, that's the kind of person he likes to portray.
Absolutely. And, I mean, his films seem to me to have very honest conversations between men and women. You know, I think of William Holden talking with, I forget the actress's name now, in Sunset Boulevard, not...
Gloria Swanson.
No.
Nancy Olsen. Nancy Olsen.
Yeah, they have this really honest conversation about, you know, their parallel careers in Hollywood, basically. And there's just a... I never feel when I'm watching a Billy Wilder movie that I'm in any way being talked down to, or things are being dumbed down. I always feel smart as the people on screen. And the people on screen, even if it's Marilyn Monroe in Some Like It Hot, are smart in terms of that they have sort of self-knowledge, and they have some, you know, there's a smartness to them. I mean, Wilder couldn't produce a dumb blonde. You know, his version of a dumb blonde has a level of knowledge which actually puts the men around her a little bit to shame.
Yeah, she's very, very shrewd, a survivor, very shrewd person, like everybody in Wilder films. And Nancy Olsen, I love that character she plays. She's a story editor. And some of my favorite people in Hollywood were story editors who, when I was there as a screenwriter in the 70s and 80s, they tended to be bright young women in their late 20s who had gone to some really good school and very sophisticated, but they tended to work for some male jerk producer in those days. And when I met Nancy Olsen...
And probably in these days as well.
There are a lot more women producers now. Sure. I mean, there were some back then, but, you know, back then it was worse. But when I met Nancy Olsen, it's funny, I said to her, you know, I dated a number of story editors because they reminded me of your character in Sunset Boulevard. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, so sorry to hear that. And then that was the only chance I had to talk to her. And I worried about that for decades. And I always wondered what she meant. And I finally, there was a guy who did a podcast with me, and he did one with Nancy Olsen because she published her autobiography recently. She's still with us and still sharp. She's in her 90s and a beautiful woman. She got more beautiful as she got older. But anyway, he said to her, why did you say that to Joe McBride? And she said, oh, I always thought Betty was an opportunist, the girl in the film, an opportunist. And I guess I can see what she means, because Betty is a story editor, but she wants to be a screenwriter. And so she's latching onto William Holden, who's a kind of a struggling, failed screenwriter. And she sees his potential that other people don't see. And so they're working on a script together. And if that's opportunism, that's the good form of opportunism, I think. I mean, but she's a very sincere, kind, she's, you know, like a number of the women in Wilder films, she's emotionally honest and direct and intelligent. And she's trying to save this guy from self-destruction. There's a great scene in the film when he's trying to tell her about his seeming life, and he invites her to the mansion that he shares with Gloria Swanson, the old silent star. And he's trying to tell her that he's a gigolo or a kept man. And she basically says, I'm not hearing any of this. I don't want to hear this. You know, don't tell me. Let's just get out of here. And you want to scream at the screen, get the hell out of here, you know, with that terrific young woman and save your life. But he's trying to be noble and tell her to leave him because he's a bad lot, you know, but I mean, he's wrong. But so she's not an opportunist in a bad sense, but I guess everybody in Hollywood is an opportunist in some sense because they're always ambitious, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a feature of just not having much power. If you don't have any power, you've got to take your chances where they come. If power can be defined by a certain luxury of not having to take those opportunities. You have a wealth of opportunities to choose from. One thing I wanted to ask Joe is you've interviewed Billy on several occasions, and you're saying earlier on you had having lunch with him as well. What was your relationship like him? What was he like in the flesh, so to speak?
Yeah, well, when I was 26, I interviewed him on the set of The Front Page, which is a play that I love, the great Hecton MacArthur newspaper play. And I was new to Hollywood, and I'd already been writing about him since 1970. I'd written some articles, reviews of his late films. And so I wanted to meet him, and I went on the set of The Front Page and got an interview with him. And he let me watch the whole filming for a whole day. And I interviewed Lemon and Matthau and the cinematographer and the producer and I.L. Diamond. It was a wonderful day. And Wilder was probably the best interviewee you could possibly imagine. I mean, I'm sure you wish you were still around because he was so quotable. I mean, he was an old newspaper guy. I mean, I think my first impression was I'm an old newspaper guy and I get along with old newspaper guys get along. And I mean, I was only 26, but I started when I was 12. And so I kind of recognized the kindred spirit, and I think he felt the same. So we could talk easily, you know, and I asked him about I said, does the Front Page reflect any of your early newspaper experiences? And he says, hardly. It would be very censorable even today, for example. And I felt the same way when I met Sam Fuller, who was an old newspaper guy. We hit it off like instantly, you know. So Wilder was just a tremendous interviewee. And I published the interview in Sight and Sound and a Boston underground paper. So I interviewed Wilder a number of times over the years. I called him occasionally when I was on Variety, and I would ask for a quote on something. And sometimes he said, well, I don't have anything to say on that subject. And I said, okay. But the best interview I did with him, Todd McCarthy and I interviewed him for 2 days in his office in 1978 about Fedora had come out in Europe, but it still hadn't come out in America. And it was being delayed, and he was in a kind of a dark mood. But we wanted to ask him about his late career because the later work from Sherlock Holmes onward has been really neglected. That's another reason I wrote this book. And I think it's a great period for Wilder, as I mentioned. And so Todd.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And I wanted to really get his opinion on his later work and also current films, and also to ask him about some riddles about his career, you know, like Maurice Zalotto, biographer of his, said that the key to Wilder's life was that he was in love with this beautiful girl in Berlin, and one day, actually, I think he said Vienna, and one day he went out into the park and found out she was a hooker, And this changed his whole view of women. Anyway, so I asked Wilder about that, and he said, "Ah, bullshit," you know. And you know, I said, "I wouldn't have gone with a hooker in those days because, you know, you'd get syphilis and, you know, blah blah blah." And but he never quite denied the story, you know. Mm. So it may be true, but so it was a great interview, and Wilder liked it so much when it came out, he called Todd's phone machine, left a message, "Thank you very much." So we had a great interview with him, and I interviewed him on other occasions too, and it was just wonderful to talk to him. I was thinking of, I wanted to do an interview book with him. I did Hawks on Hawks, which is Howard Hawks' interview book, and when I went to Hollywood in 1970, I had already participated in a discussion with Hawks at the Chicago Film Festival, and so I looked him up, and he was very available because he was not making films, and I wanted to learn from him because I was an aspiring screenwriter and Hawks was a great storyteller. So I kept recording these interviews with Hawks, and then I realized eventually I had enough for a book, and I put it together actually after he died. So I thought of doing one with Wilder, and but for whatever reason I never asked him. I think I was kind of reluctant, I don't know why. In 1995, when I was sitting with him, one of my colleagues said to Wilder, "You know, Joe would like to do an interview book with you." And Wilder just kind of looked at me, and I didn't say anything. And I didn't realize that Cameron Crowe was doing one at the time, and that's why he didn't say anything. You know, Cameron Crowe, the writer-director, did a book on Wilder, which is fairly good, but, you know, I think it could have been a lot better. But, you know, I have this theory that life turns out the way it's supposed to, and I guess I was meant to do a critical study of Wilder. It's not a biography. People sometimes call it a biography because it has biographical elements, but I don't write biographies anymore because, frankly, they're too expensive to write. I did three of them. I did Capra, Ford, and Spielberg, and those were huge endeavors, and I I poured my own money into them. And I was in dire financial straits each time I did one. So I've been going back to what I did at the beginning of my career, which is writing critical studies of people. I started by writing critical studies of Wells and John Ford. And the Ford book I did with Michael Wilmington in 1969-71 is coming out again this December. And I've added some new material at the end about various aspects of Ford and a lot of new photographs and things. And I'm going to bring the Wells book back into print when I get a chance. But I've enjoyed writing these critical studies of Lubitsch and Wilder and the Coen brothers, you know, because it's a fascinating genre, commenting on their work and bringing in biography when it's relevant, you know. But just going on in depth about their work is really fun to do and interesting, I think.
Yeah, that's what I'm finishing my first biography at the moment, and I find one of the things I noticed when I got to the end of it, it's kind of the opposite of what you're saying in a sense, or the opposite experience is I got to the end and I reread it and I thought, oh, wait a second, I might actually have to say something about the films, because I, you know, I kind of get to the end of every chapter and it's just like, and then we're on to another film, or then we're doing something else, and it's like, actually I should stop a minute and just say what I think of the film, not
yeah. Well, you go into Malick, I'm sure you go into the genesis of all these films and how he made the films, and that's all. We don't know much about that because he's been a mysterious figure, so I'm dying to read your book because I think a lot of people will feel that way, that this guy's a mystery man. I interviewed him way back in the early 70s myself, but you've broken a lot of new ground with your book, so it's going to be fascinating. But when I do a biography, those three big biographies I've done, they're what's called critical biographies because I go into criticism of the films too, you know, and people confuse the word criticism with negativity. I mean, it's just analysis, critical analysis of the films. But for example, with John Ford, I felt that a biography was needed because here's this guy who was portrayed himself as an uncouth, semi-literate cowboy, but he was actually a very sophisticated, well-read guy, but he didn't want to admit it. But he made these very beautiful, sensitive, moving emotional films, and you know, the riddle was, how did this character make these beautiful poetic films? And so I wanted to solve that riddle. I felt that was really important, because I think people didn't understand Ford, because they didn't see the connection very well. And Ford tried to hide a lot about his life too. And so I dug into that for a long time. It took about 30 years to research that book. And then Frank Capra's life was completely unknown, in a sense, because his autobiography is almost a complete pack of lies. So I was inventing the wheel in Capra biography and criticism, in a sense, because people had his films very confused, because they didn't realize the importance of his writers, who tended to be liberals or even communists, and Capra was a conservative, and people didn't know that, you know. So I mean, I write these books to correct myths or misapprehensions or injustices. And with Wilder, you know, I was kind of bothered by the fact that people didn't understand him clearly enough for the reasons I mentioned before. They thought he was cynical or misogynist, and they didn't understand his later work. You know, people kind of dismissed his later work. And, you know, I mean, it's funny, after I wrote the book, but before it came out, I showed Avadi to some friends of mine. And these people were retired university professors, highly intelligent, sophisticated people. And they didn't like Avadi because they thought it was anti-Italian, because it's made on the island of Ischia. And it's a very funny movie. And it deals with cultural clash between this sort of ugly American character played by Jack Lemmon and these much more laid back, fun-loving, sensual Italian people. And it's a very warm, sweet, charming film, but they thought it was anti-Italian because it makes a lot of ethnic jokes. And then one of them said, "Oh, it's also anti-American." And I thought, wait a minute, this is somebody who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, which is where I live, calling a movie by Billy Wilder anti-American. Well, actually, it kind of is, because he's very critical of the ugly American character. But that's one of the great things when you get back to, you mentioned a lot of the European filmmakers came over partly because of Hitler and changed our culture. Lubitsch came before Wilder, and Wilder, with his dark sense of humor, said Lubitsch was one of the fortunate ones who was brought over and didn't have to flee. In other words, Wilder had to flee, but a lot of great filmmakers came over and changed our country, because our films were still kind of puritanical and Victorian. Griffith still dominated the cinema, great filmmaker, but very Victorian. When Lubitsch came over in 1922, he really revolutionized the American cinema. Jean Renoir said Lubitsch invented Hollywood. And he invented the romantic comedy and the musical, basically. And then Billy Wilder helped in the 40s and 50s, especially, to make us a much more sophisticated, intelligent country. You know, as you were saying, when you see a Wilder film, you don't feel talked down to, you feel talked straight to, you know. And when you see a film like The Apartment, it's funny, when some of the reviews of The Apartment were kind of shocked. Hollis Alpert wrote this silly review in the Saturday Review saying it was a dirty fairy tale, and it was shocking that a guy would use his apartment to move up in the office by letting the executives screw their girlfriends. Well, I mean, yeah, okay, sure. I mean, like, he was shocked. It shows how naive people were. But Wilder at first was offended when it was called a dirty fairy tale. And then he thought, yeah, okay, dirty fairy tale is a pretty good expression. So he began using that himself. But, you know, another reason I wrote this book is I love, love, love Kiss Me Stupid, which is a wonderful movie, 1964. Wilder was ahead of his time by 3 or 4 years. If he had made that in 67, 68, 69, people wouldn't have been shocked. But it's a very raunchy, very witty sex comedy. It's about sexual hypocrisy in a small town in America. And it's very true to life, and it's very full of double entendres. It's a very romantic film. I said to Wilder, you know, I think that film is very romantic. And he said, yeah, you know, I think so too. But, He said, I'd like to do it again to show them how romantic it was. But he said, could you imagine if I went in and said, I'd like to do Kiss Me Stupid again? And I said, well, you could call it Kiss Me Again Stupid. I was alluding to a Lubitsch film called Kiss Me Again. And Wilder said, yeah, Kiss Me Stupid, Kiss Me Once and Kiss Me Twice and Kiss Me Once Again Stupid, you know. But it's a great film, but he was pilloried. He and I.L. Diamond, his co-writer, were pilloried for making this film. And it's based on a play by Anna Bonacci, an Italian playwright, which is considered a classic play in Europe. And it's when it's done in Europe, people love it, and it made help make Jean Moreau a star when it was done in France, for example. And but Americans were so sexually repressed and hypocritical in 1964 that they, you know, Wilder said Tommy Thompson in Life magazine wrote that he should be deported for making this film. I looked up the article. He didn't actually write that. This was Wilder's biggest anxiety, that somebody would say he should be deported, because, you know, you think of him as an immigrant lucky to be in the country. But Thompson wrote this hysterical piece accusing him of kind of warping American culture and lowering all our cultural values.
You had that with Sunset Boulevard as well, didn't you? With Louis B. Mayer, yeah, sort of shouting, you know, you've come to this country and you've, you know, you've sort of shit in the nest, so to speak, pardon my French, and they should send you back. And according to one of the versions you have in the book, he replied, "Go fuck yourself."
He said, and I mean, you know, the versions we have are just Wilder's versions, but he said, Mayer, who was an immigrant himself, said, you know, you should be sent back to where you came from because you've, made this terrible film about our industry, and we gave you a helping hand, lifted you out of the water, and look what you've done to us. And he says, go fuck yourself, Mr. Mayer, you know, which took a lot of guts because Mayer was still a very powerful man at the time. But I think you're right. I'm glad you brought that up, because maybe Mayer didn't exactly say that, but that was the implication, perhaps, just like with Tommy Thompson's article, that Wilder took it as his worst fear is that he would somehow be deported. Maybe in his nightmares, that's what he would think, you know.
And you also have this really interesting point that he would get very down on his own sort of accent and his own imperfect English, shall we say. Whereas there's a sort of David Niven-esque urge to take certain of these émigrés like Michael Curtiz and sort of, you know, David Niven, I think, used the title from one of his malapropisms, you know, bring on the empty horses. With Wilder, there was a real there's a story you recount of Barbara Streisand sort of taking the Mickey out of his accent and him being very quiet for the rest of the evening and not taking it all well.
Yeah, that's another example of his sensitivity. That his accent was delightful and charming, but Barbara Streisand, as you say, was imitating his accent at a party, and he stopped talking, which was very atypical of him. But he felt terrible about it, and he was always sensitive about it. And I found an interesting quote from Selke Vertel, who was this screenwriter, emigre, who had a famous literary salon in Hollywood in the 30s. And she wrote in a very subtle way about accents. She said that people like to patronize foreigners in Hollywood for having a charming, funny accent, you know, but there was, she felt there was a kind of an edge to it, you know, kind of a nasty edge to it, even if they said, oh, doesn't he have a wonderful, cute, charming accent? And that's kind of how people viewed Billy Wilder. But I mean, the way he talked was so terrific. Paul Diamond, who is I.L. Diamond's son, was a good source of mine. And he said, you know, nobody was as witty or clever than Billy Wilder, but he always felt he needed a colleague who didn't have an accent to work with. And his father, Is Diamond, as they called him, was from Romania, but he came over when he was 9. And when you're 9 years old, you lose your accent, you know, just like Frank Capra lost his Italian accent when he came to America. But Wilder came when he was in his 30s, and so he never lost his accent. So Wilder liked to work with Diamond. And Paul felt that Wilder always had a kind of insecurity about his English, even though nobody was smarter and cleverer than Wilder. But he needed somebody to kind of sort out some of the idioms and the grammar or whatever. At least he felt he did. I mean, I'm sure he could have succeeded on his own. I mean, one of the sad things about Wilder is when Diamond died, Wilder never made another film. They made a unfortunately bad film called Buddy Buddy, and it bombed, and they never got to make another film. Wilder was what I call an internal exile the last 20 or so years of his life. Nobody would let him make a film in America, and he kept wanting to make films. And that's another reason I wrote this book. I was really, really angry about this, and I still am. The idea that Billy Wilder couldn't make a film. I remember in the 70s, I was talking to a producer in the Universal Commissary, and she was going to do a romantic comedy. And she said, I can't think of anybody today who can do a romantic comedy. And I said, well, what about Billy Wilder? And she said, Billy Wilder, he's not bankable. And I thought, this is so outrageous. You know, I mean, Billy Wilder, not bankable, but that was the truth. And it's very sad that this guy was shunned. And part of it, though, he didn't have Diamond around anymore. But they did work for a few years after Buddy Buddy on various projects. And one of the things I tried to do was to find out what some of these projects were. And I interviewed people who knew him, and I got some good stories about some of the films that he wanted to do, which were quite wacky and surreal to some extent. I mean, one of them, probably the best one was, it was going to be the story of H.B. Warner, who played Jesus in The King of Kings for Cecil B. DeMille in the 20s. And Warner was an old drunk and whoremonger, and they didn't want him getting into a scandal when he was playing Jesus. So he would slip across the border to Tijuana on the weekends and go to brothels and get loaded and, you know, do these things. And so Wilder wanted to make a movie about that, and he wanted Walter Matthau to be play the publicist on the film, who has the job of trying to control this out of control old guy. And I think that would have been a hilarious movie about silent Hollywood. I asked Wilder, he was very cagey about talking about his projects, because, you know, people could steal the ideas. And he said, I said, what's that story about the silent movie story you have? And he said, well, it's really Roots. It's the story of the Mayer family. And what was the title? He had a very funny sexual title that he was going to call it. But anyway, he was, he kind of told me the basic storyline, but he didn't go into detail. And I wish he had made that film.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I know what he called it, the Foreskin Saga. That's right. I'm sure that wasn't the title, but that's a typical example of his wit off the cuff, you know, the Foreskin Saga
instead of the Forsyth Saga. Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Excellent. Just I wanted to tie together as well some of your interests and a sort of recent thing, and it ties to what you're just saying as well, because for those last 20 years of his life, he was obviously being hailed as well by people like Spielberg and like the new Hollywood directors that sort of would sort of pay homage to him, but not give him any money to make movies, or not agree to be the director and him producer or what have you. And you, in the book, you say that one of the reasons Spielberg sort of doesn't want to do the producer-director deal with Schindler's List is that he's going through a period where he's sort of rejecting father figures. And I'm interested in getting your take on Fablemans and how in the Fablemans he uses his meeting with John Ford as a kind of, you know, the point at which his career really will begin, you know, an end point and a beginning point. And I was just wondering, is there a version of the Fablemans that could have had Billy Wilder in there? You know, is there?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that happened much later, but I see your point. I mean, I made the point, you know, that throughout Spielberg's career until very late, well, I mean, until the 90s, I date the turning point around Amistad, which I think is a great film that's been neglected. The scene in which John Quincy Adams, who is wonderfully played by Anthony Hopkins, And he was the son of an American president who became president himself, but he was considered very inferior to his father. But he's now regarded more highly, and he defended these Amistad African captives, and that was kind of forgotten for a long time. So he becomes a heroic figure. But he has a scene where he addresses the bust of his father, John Adams, and a picture of George Washington, and he's talking about, we always kind of tried to deny you, I'm paraphrasing, you know, our father figures who founded our country, the founding fathers, because we were afraid we wouldn't measure up to you, basically, is what he's saying. But now we realize that who we are is who we were. And that to me is when Spielberg accepts the father figure that he had been running away from. And when I did my biography, I found out that Spielberg's father, Arnold, had been much more involved in his early movie career than Steven ever mentioned. And then I started interviewing all the kids who worked on those amateur films, which was really interesting. And one of them said, I've been waiting for 30 years for somebody to ring the doorbell and ask me for an interview, and here you are. So it's a great story that was untold. But they all said Mr. Spielberg was heavily involved in these films. And one of the guys said, I didn't know who was directing, Steven or Arnold, you know. And I also was able to piece together the true story of the divorce, which is the foundational trauma of Steven's life, you know. And he always blamed his father, but really his mother was having an affair with one of their best friends, as the Fablemans shows. But I found this out, and the father later, they did a 60 Minutes interview. Father and mother did an interview together, and Arnold said, you know, I accepted the blame. And Mrs. Spielberg, Leah, said, yeah, and I fell in love with his best friend, and it was my doing. And Arnold said, I guess I took the blame because I loved her, you know. And they played it for Steven, and he was kind of stunned. But I had sort of pieced the story together. I had to be a little careful how I wrote about it. But part of my goal in writing that book was to hopefully try to mend that wound in the family. And I think I had some role in that, I think, because soon after my book came out, they reconciled. And it was such a big deal that Life magazine put it on the cover. Steven and his father have reconciled. And I was very happy. And so he said for the last 15 years of his father's life, they were close friends. And it really meant a lot to him. So the Fablemans is his way of kind of confronting the truth about all that stuff and seeing, I wrote a piece on the Fablemans for Salon, and they asked me to compare it with what really happened. It's pretty close to what actually happened, but he takes some liberties. He and Tony Kushner, his co-writer, but basically it's a kind of forgiveness of his parents. I mean, Eugene O'Neill, I always thought was wonderful comment. He said, we have to forgive our parents, you know. Yeah. We're all angry at our parents for what they did to us, because parents are not perfect people, and we all have to kind of forgive them, or you can never move on, become an adult. And that's what Steven has finally done. And I think he started that process in the late 90s with Amistad and being close to Arnold. I had a wonderful interview with Arnold Spielberg, just a wonderful guy, and he was kind of the family historian. He gave me all kinds of priceless family history that nobody else knew, and nobody had interviewed him before or since. Later people did interview, of course, but before that he was not being interviewed. Mrs. Spielberg, Leah, was interviewed a lot because she was a colorful character. So I was able to get Steven didn't interfere with my book. When people called up to say, should we talk to McBride, they were told I was kosher, which was very nice. He wouldn't talk to me himself because he said he's saving it for his autobiography. But I think it's because he's a control freak and I'm a control freak. And, you know, I made it clear it's an unauthorized biography, as I always do. Mm-hmm. But the only person who didn't talk to me because Steven told her not to was the mother. Mm-hmm. And I talked to her on the phone, and she said, you know, I was told not to talk to you. And I said, who told you? And she said, the gods. And she was very sweet, very charming. But she said so many things in interviews that I was able to quote her on almost every subject.
Yeah.
But Arnold, I wouldn't have had his side of the story if I hadn't had my personal interview with him.
But I think also Saving Private Ryan felt like a very much a rapprochement moment.
Oh,
where
yeah.
he was very much, and it's kind of interesting because I've been looking at Saving Private Ryan in relationship to The Thin Red Line, because they're both coming out in the same year, they're both being made at the same time. Interestingly, mm-hmm. like they have cast members who were auditioning for both films, and Barry Pepper, who turns up in this is an exclusive. Don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone this.
Okay, don't tell anybody.
Yeah. You can actually see him in one of the shots in Thin Red Line. And he's also in Saving Private Ryan. So he's the one actor who somehow, he's not credited. He doesn't have a role, but he actually appears in Thin Red Line very briefly.
Well, I guess there were people like Adrian Brody thought he had a big part. He thought he was the star of the film, and then he went to the premiere and he was hardly in the film apparently. Yeah.
That's one of the myths. You remember you were saying about writing books?
That's a myth.
Yeah, I don't, it wasn't the, I don't think he ever claimed it was a premiere. I think George Clooney gave a version of this which sounds very truthful, which was that he was at a junket after it had shown, I presume maybe even at Berlin, but it was at some junket, and the journalists were going, so what are you in the film? What part do you play?
Yeah,
and he's like, but haven't you seen the film? It's like, no, we saw it, but we, you know, what are you in the film? Well, you know, and he was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I'm not.
These
the
stories
film.
Are a little more complicated than they get told, but that's true. That film was Steven's tribute to his father. I mean, all through his career, even his amateur films, he's obsessed with World War II because his father was in World War II. And I think we're all kind of nostalgic for the period right before we were born. I was born in 47 and I missed World War II. I guess I'm lucky I missed it, but I kind of am fascinated by it because it happened right before I was born, like Stephen. But his dad was in the Burma operations, and he was a radio operator, and he and I talked about that. And so Stephen was always interested in aviation, and his father was did a little flying in the war, and he was also working with radios with the airplanes and stuff. And so that film was very much homage to his father. And for example, he told his father, I'm going to shoot this in black and white because I see World War II in black and white. He said that about Schindler's List. I see the Holocaust in black and white. And his father said, well, I was there and I saw it in color, you know. So Stephen made Saving Private Ryan in color because his father told him to. So that's an example of father's influence. But I was the saddest moment I had when as a biographer was when Stephen's father said to me, you know more about Steve than I do, he said. I thought, geez, I mean, wow. I mean, I guess I know a lot about him, but I sometimes think, you know, for example, I know a lot about Capra's parents, although I wish I had met them, but I know more about them than I do about my own parents almost, you know, because when your parents are alive, you don't always sit and think I should interview my father at great length about his life, and I sure wish I had, because there are a lot of things I didn't ask him about. You know, he was in World War II, and we couldn't get him to talk about it. Veterans in that period were reticent about talking about it for a variety of reasons, and Stephen's father, I don't know, I guess he was a little reticent about it too, but Stephen just loved his father, and he realized, you know, you are who made you, your parents, both your parents, Stephen. One of the best insights I had, there was a woman in Cincinnati named Millie Teeger, who was an old friend of Leah Adler Spielberg. Adler was her second married name. But she said that when she saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, she said, that's Stephen's mother and father. The father is the scientific grandeur of the spaceship and everything, and the mother is the music, because his mother was a concert pianist, as you can see in Fablemans, and the father was this computer pioneer who actually had some patents on computers. And so that was a very shrewd comment, that when they they communicate with us, the aliens, by playing music with colored lights and all that. That's the mother and father, you know.
Oh, the combination comes together. Yeah.
And I read a book. Was it Carl Jung wrote a book called Flying Saucers? And I thought, I'm going to read this book. And it was actually very revealing of Steven Spielberg, because he said that in times of great psychic stress, we think we see UFOs. He had psychological explanations for UFOs. He didn't believe they actually existed. But he said that people wanted gods from the skies. He also said we live in an age when people don't believe in God as much as they used to, and so we believe in mechanical gods from the skies. But he said when people have great psychic stress in their family life or in society, they fantasize about UFOs. And Spielberg fantasized about UFOs because he wanted father figure from the sky, like in E.T. and also that film is about Close Encounters is about a broken family. And also he said at the time it was a UFO Watergate. Watergate was going on, and that idea kind of fell into the background of the film. But you can see in the film that the government is keeping the secret from the public, and that's the Watergate element. So that was a period of great psychic stress for the whole country. And Carl Jung helped me understand Steven Spielberg.
Bless him for helping out. I can't wait to have another conversation with you, because I feel like every time we talk, there are vistas opening up, and I'd love to dedicate a couple more episodes at least to individual books that you've written.
I'd love to.
To wind our conversation up for today about Mr. Wilder, what film do you think? Because you were in the book, you're arguing very much that more attention should be paid to some of his later films. There are some of his films that have been neglected or were neglected at the time. What film of Billy Wilder's would you sort of suggest for people who maybe know his work glancingly to sort of reacquaint themselves with, or that they may not have seen? What would you?
Okay, well, I'll mention two, and they're very different kinds of films. But sure. One of the great things about Wilder was that he didn't like. He told me, he said, "I don't want to keep making the same film over and over." He said, "I love Mr. Hitchcock, but you kind of know what Hitchcock is going to do." And Hitchcock felt kind of trapped eventually by being so-called master of suspense. Wilder made comedies and dramas and comedy dramas. I would say Avanti, which I adore, and I think in some ways maybe that's Wilder's best film, and that will surprise people because it's kind of not very well known and it didn't get good reviews, but it's a completely charming film and very poignant, and it's about death and it's about love, and it's very complex. It's about an American abroad, and it becomes a better person by going to Europe and by meeting a sexually liberated young woman. It's just a very rich film and beautiful to look at. It's just a lovely film, very romantic. And then the other one is Ace in the Hole, which I doubt that many people have seen, but there's a terrific Criterion disc of it. That's a great newspaper film. It's the most corrosive, dark film Billy Wilder ever made in a career filled with dark films. I mean, Double Indemnity is pretty darn dark, but
possibly Kirk Douglas's best performance as well. Just unbelievably powerful.
Yeah, I wrote a little biography of Kirk Douglas a long time ago too, and he was a very, very bright fellow. Kazan said that Douglas was the most intelligent actor he ever worked with, which is a great compliment. But he said he was dissatisfied with his career, which is interesting. That shows intelligence. I worked with Douglas briefly on something and really had a good rapport with him. But he's great in this film. He plays this completely ruthless, heartless SOB of a newspaper guy who's trying to get back to New York. He's been exiled to Albuquerque, New Mexico, because he gets in trouble every time he goes onto a newspaper. And he seizes upon a cave-in, and there's a man trapped in a cave, and he keeps this guy trapped in a cave to build the drama of the story. I won't go any further, but it's a very sharp look at how ruthless newspaper people can be. And Wilder said he based it partly on his experience with newspaper people back in Vienna and Berlin, you know. And when you look at the newspaper reporters in the front page in Chicago in the 20s, one reason I like Wilder's film on the front page, there, most people prefer His Girl Friday, but Wilder told me, he said, that's more like Leo McCarey's The Awful Truth than the front page. I like the play The Front Page, and Wilder's film is quite close to it, but it's quite a harsh portrait of journalists. They're, those guys are really bastards in that film. And
tell him his prayer stinks and kick him down the stairs.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite lines ever from any film.
Yeah. Walter Matthau is satanic. Neil Sinyard and another fellow wrote a critical study of Wilder, and they said it's a version of Faust with Walter Matthau playing Mephistopheles, which is really true. It's about the battle for the soul of Jack Lemmon's newspaper guy. And boy, it's a rough portrait of journalism, but I mean, having been a journalist my whole life, I can see the truth in all this. I wrote a book that came out in 2021 that I was very proud of. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention. It's called Political Truth, The Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy. And I've been studying this subject since he was shot, actually even before he was shot. I wrote a short story about his assassination in 1961 because I was worried about him. I worked as a volunteer for him in 1960, and I got to meet him up close during the primary campaign. I saw that he didn't have any security, and so I wrote a short story for my freshman high school English class about his assassination. But anyway, the media have been lying to us in America, the mainstream media, about his death ever since. And it's the alternate media and podcasts and books and films, you know, been trying to tell the truth. But so I wrote a book really analyzing the failure and the corruption of the media, especially the New York Times and the Washington Post. But I also analyze films and books and all the different media in Political Truth. It's a book I'm very proud of. And so I've been writing, I'm a kind of media critic myself, and I've taught courses on media criticism, films about media criticism. And I always start with Ace in the Hole, and it blows the minds of the students. They can't believe that this film was made in Hollywood in 1951. It is such an amazingly honest and corrosive film. They just think it's great. And, you know, it has one of the biggest fans of that film is Spike Lee. He just adores that film. And he became a friend of Wilder. He looked him up because of Ace in the Hole, and they became pals, hung out together, and he wanted to remake that film. I normally don't like the idea of remakes of great films, but I could see where you could do it differently now in the age of television.
Yeah.
And that film was made right when TV was getting started. And actually the impetus for it was a little girl fell into a well in Los Angeles in 1949, I believe it was. And that was
which Woody Allen comments on in Radio Days.
Radio Days, it's anachronistic because that's the 1930s, but you know, he moves it around. But her name was Kathy Fiscus, and there was a local LA TV channel that broadcast this rescue operation live for 3 days, I think it was, and she died, unfortunately. But it became the first sort of live media TV event of people sort of voyeuristically getting off on tragedy, and Wilder was inspired by that. Actually, one of his fellow writers was inspired by that and brought the story to him. And there was a later story, CNN had a whole story about a little girl fell down a well in Texas and fortunately was rescued. That was a big deal. You know, the whole country was riveted by that. But so
do you remember the story of the boy in the balloon as well, that where they actually tried to kind of manufacture that sort of story, but of course there was no boy in the balloon and it was all a fake. It was all set up.
I don't remember. I think I'm vaguely remembering that now. That's true. And, well, and, the ultimate source of Ace in the Hole was in 1925, a guy named Floyd Collins was trapped in a cave in Kentucky, and a reporter crept into the cave and got interviews with him and won the Pulitzer Prize. And it became a national event. This was in the days of newspapers and radio. And so it's kind of partly based on the Floyd Collins story, too.
Right, right.
You know, but Wilder and his fellow writers whipped it into a contemporary story in 1951. And yeah, Kirk Douglas is really just like the most satanic, hard-boiled guy. But you can understand him. He's desperate to get back into the big time. And his editor is a fascinating character. Porter Hall, character actor, plays an editor with a lot of sense of conscience. He's sort of, you know, Billy Wilder has these figures in his films who are kind of consciences, but he's also his enabler too. It's complex. You know, it's really a fascinating film, and it was filmed mostly in New Mexico. I went to Albuquerque a few years ago to try to see the locations, and I realized the only scene taking place in Albuquerque was actually shot in Los Angeles. So I didn't get to see that, but they shot a lot of it in out on the highway. There was a big mountain nearby there, you know. Right. But that was one of I like to go to places where films are shot.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. It's a brilliant. It's kind of writing books is a brilliant excuse to do that as well. To just like, oh, I need it. It's research, and how much it's actually research, and how much is just me wanting to go places is open for discussion.
Well, I guess you went to Texas, or Terry Malick came from Texas.
Yeah, yeah. Went to Waco and Smithville where they shot Tree of Life.
Wow. And I met Terry Malick's father. He introduced me to his dad when I was interviewing Malick, and his father happened to come in the office, and he's a nice man. You know, there's my dad, you know. But that's the fun part of writing a biography is the research. You know, you get to travel around the country or the world, and, you know, like with Wilder and Lubitsch, to see the films, I had to go to Germany and Switzerland. And, you know, when I say had to, I mean, that was the fun part, to get to see these films. For example, Wilder's first screenplay credit, Der Teufels Reporter, which means the devil's reporter. I had to go to the German Film Institute in Berlin to see that. And a lot of Lubitsch films, were not existing in America at the time. So I went to Germany and Switzerland. And recently I've been doing audio commentaries on Lubitsch silent films are being released by Kino Lorber, and I've done commentaries on films like The Oyster Princess and Meyer from Berlin and The Doll and various other films. But that's part of the fun of it. And then they lock you in a room for several years when you have to write the book, and that's not the fun part. As you know, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm quite happy. And William S. Burroughs said, if you're not happy sitting in a room on your own for 8 hours, don't be a writer. And that's
well, that's true. I mean, I actually, when you were saying this, I kind of thought, wait a minute, I've been doing this my whole life, and it is the craft. You know what it comes down to is you have to love the craft, and I love the craft of writing. And you know, one thing I've learned over the years, when I first started writing, I kind of knew what I was going to write before I wrote it, but now when I write a book, it's I don't know what I'm going to write exactly until I write it. And I've read other writers say that you never know really what you think until you write it, which is an interesting way to look at it. And that's exciting. That is a challenge to try to put it down the way, you know, it really, you know, as Hemingway said, not what you're supposed to feel or think, but what you really thought and felt. You know,
absolutely.
That's the challenge. So I was being a little glib there about being locked in a room. I don't mind being locked in a room. You have to be willing to do that to be a writer, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for talking to me once more, Joe. And I really I look forward to future conversations.
Sure, John, anytime. It's really a delight talking with you. You have such a wide range of interests, like I do. So we always have a good talk. It's terrific. Thank you.